like I said in the email, it's called the Dream Share Project, and we're basically just traveling across the country interviewing inspirational people like yourself who are chasing their dreams, and our goal is to encourage young people and all sorts of people to start thinking about their dreams and start doing something about it, start chasing them. So that's what we're doing, and we're trying to put the film and the book and the website and all that good stuff. So, and if it's okay with you, is it all right if I record the conversation?
Yes. All okay. Right.
Wonderful. Okay. I guess to start, if you could just tell us your name and what you do.
My name is Lewis Black, LuisBlack. I'm the editor of the Austin Chronicle. I'm an executive director of South by Southwest. And that's, I guess, most of what I do.
Cool. And do you want to tell us a little bit about your childhood, like where you grew up and what sorts of things you were interested in?
I grew up in Phoenix, New Jersey, right across the river from New York City. It was a weird childhood in that I have no skill sets. I'm not athletic. My handwriting is illegible. I'm tone deaf. And I also had huge attention issues. So I did terrible in school. And school was like a nightmare for me. But and especially because my older sister was a year older. She was always a year ahead of me. Was a spectacular student. She's an educator now. For years, she ran Milton Academy in Massachusetts, the lower school, and now she's working at Columbia University, running an in-house school for them. But she consults with private schools all the time, and so the junior high school, you know, when you start changing classes at the beginning of the year, I always get, oh, are you Jeff Black's brother? And it would be like, oh, God, it's going to be even worse than I can imagine. Because I just flunk everything. I mean, I just really had big school problems, and the only, like, you know, I had taught myself how to read in second grade, and then I started reading at, like, a fifth grade level or sixth grade level. So even stuff like English I did terrible at. I can't spell. So on the one hand, it was that academic thing that was just depressing because I loved my parents and I constantly disappointed them. On the other hand, when I was 12 or 13, I was friendly with Leonard Maltin before, but I became very close friends with Leonard Maltin. He's the guy that on Entertainment Tonight does the TV movie books and does like a lot of film history. And he and I, when we were about 13, began to go to New York City together to watch movies. So that, I mean, there was just a long period of time where we would go into the city, and we might go to the city in the morning. We'd go to, there used to be like a ton of used bookstores around 14th Street, so we'd go hit the Book Row, is what it's called, and go, you know, shopping in used bookstores, and then we'd go, like, to the 11 o'clock at the Museum of Modern Art, and then maybe the 1 o'clock at Dundergan Hartford, and then 3:30 at the Museum of Modern Art, and then we'd go to Film Society in the evening. So we're, you know, so there was, that was going on, and it was amazing how much film, you know, how many films we saw, because we also met collectors, and they would invite us over to their house to show us films. So that was happening. And then when I was 14, it turned out I was real fascinated by comic books. And I went over to Lens one time, and he had a list of comic books for sale. And in the list was fanzines, comic fanzines that you could order. And I ordered a couple of them. And in one of them, it was a long letter from Otto Binder, who was a writer, science fiction writer from 33 to about 41, although he would write it on and off after that. And from 41 on, he was a comic book writer. So he wrote, like, you know, most of the Captain Marvel, the original Captain Marvel. He introduced, you know, Supergirl, and when Jimmy Olsen got his own book, I was writing, and he wrote a lot of Superman, tons of comics, and it turned out he was in the town next to me, so I sent him a letter and asked him if I could interview him, which was audacious because I'd never interviewed him before, and he invited me over, and so I spent a lot of time hanging out. He had to write all the time, because comic book writers are all freelancers, so they had no insurance, and you know, they didn't know what they wrote, so I'd go over on Saturdays and Sundays, and he would write for a long time, and then he would come out, and and the room, like half the room was the writing room, the other half was filled with old comic books and pulp magazines. So I just sit there and read all day until he was done, and then we could tell me stories about, you know, all of that period. And then we also would go into like science fiction and comic book conventions in New York together. So I got to meet like everybody's family, and I remember pushing Arthur C. Clarke out of the way because I wanted to see what Samuel Delaney looked like, a science fiction writer. So it was like an interesting deal in that up until like about 10 years ago, 15 years ago, I suddenly realized that, like, never anybody else I told how rotten my childhood was, because the good stuff didn't seem important at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, you know, I had an amazing childhood, but I was depressed about all that.
Gotcha. And do you want to tell us about college and what you studied?
Well, I went to College of Basic Studies at Boston University, which is a two-year school connected to BU. It was 1968 to 1970, so I didn't do well enough to get into the regular college there because there was a lot of political activity. And then from 70, I went to a school in Vermont that's no longer there called Wyndham College. 70 to about 72, and I think I got a degree in English, of course, and then I bummed around for a while. I lived in New Hampshire, Vermont, South Carolina, Florida, just where I knew anybody I'd go live. And I used to be in Texas, and I came and I stayed here in Austin for a while. I liked it, but I went back to the east of a girlfriend. And then when she graduated school, I applied to some graduate schools, got an EP in the English department, so we moved down here because I loved Austin. And I hated meeting English writers. It was like so foreign, and was reading books about books about books. You know, it was not reading novels. It was really a distance experience. And once again, knowing Glenn paid off, because Glenn, there was a teacher in the film department was writing a book on Buster Keaton, and he kind of, if you're going to write on Buster Keaton, well, Glenn's one of the people you want to talk to, because he just knows his Keaton stuff upside down, inside out. And so Glenn said, why don't you go over and visit George Weed, who's a professor? And I did, and I'd get to hang out with some of the film graduate students, and George said to me at one point, you know, if you want to become a film graduate student, that's no problem. And I said, nah, I don't think legitimate to study film in college. And then the next semester I asked if I could become a film graduate student because I hated being an English graduate student so much. And then at that point, the oddest thing in my entire life, I became an academic star because I've been watching movies seriously since I was 12. Whereas I hadn't seen as many of the tour movies or the great classics as other people. I had seen so many more of two-reel shorts and cartoons and newsreels and programmers and B-movies. I mean, so much more. And so I had, you know, this incredible body of knowledge that I didn't even realize I had. And being an academic star for me was very odd considering my run-up to it.
And so what happened after that?
So I was a graduate student and I was having the time of my life. I was writing, I was producing movies. One of them was producing finals to the Student Academy Awards, and it was like, you know, it was just really, I had a column in the paper, a music column in the paper, the student paper, and a film column. And then this is about 76 is when I go to Texas, 77 is when I become a film graduate student, 80 I get my master's, and then in 81 my friends Joe Dishner and Nick Barbaro announced that they wanted to start a paper for Austin, and would I be involved? And I said, sure. And we began planning the paper. And in September of 1981, we came out with the first issue. And that changed my whole life because, you know, then all the good times I was having changed because the paper was just, I mean, it was kind of like a nightmare in certain ways, pursuing the paper. Was we didn't know anything. I mean, we knew how to write, and we figured that would be enough to do it, and we didn't know about personnel or distribution or selling or anything like that. And so the next 4 or 5 years was kind of a brutal learning experience. But one of the things we did learn was that pretty much everything we did, because we I love, stuff was the right thing to do. Eventually made money. It took a while, but eventually made money. But every time we tried to make money, we fucked it up totally because, we just, I mean, it was, you know, we didn't know how to sell out. We were very bad at it. So we would try to do special issues to make money and it would be a disaster. But just doing the paper that we really loved, took about 10 years, but then it became really established. And then in 1986, in November of 1986, our friends Roland Swenson and Lewis Myers approached me and my partner in the paper, Nick Barrow. Nick Barrow and I were among the people who started the paper, and after the first year was Nick Barrow and I were the only ones left of the people who started the paper. And we were approached by Roland Swenson and Lewis J. Myers, and they suggested we start a little music event in Austin. And the idea was that it was going to be a place where, you know, it was going to be just we call it South by Southwest. We thought it was just going to cover five or six states, which is why it was called South by Southwest. And the idea was that there was, you know, a band booker in Kansas City and a music writer in New Orleans and a club owner in Austin, and sometimes who had dealt with each other in some cases for years and had never met. So we thought it would be a nice little regional meeting. And the paper still hadn't made it yet. I mean, the paper was still bi-weekly every other week and was still touch and go. But we did South by Southwest anyway. And the first one was fine. I mean, we did in the cash flow of the Chronicle, which is doing it in still water because there was no cash flow. But the first one was successful. And the second and third one were successful. And it became very quickly national and then international. And we just, our model for what we were doing was Austin, Texas. And if it was the way life was in Austin, it was good, and we didn't go for artificial stuff. So, you know, when we were graduate film students, we'd go watch movies until midnight, and then we'd go hear music until 2, and then we'd go write for a little while. And we had a projector at home, so this was kind of before VHS. And so we might borrow some of the movies that we hadn't seen on campus and watch them at home, and, you know, 4 in the morning. And so South by Southwest started out being, you know, like a Disneyland kind of thing for music lovers. I mean, it was really about the music. It was about the excitement. And then we added film in 1994 and interactive in 1994. And now it's a monster. I mean, it's like, you know, the film festival, we really added, because Nick and I were graduate film students when we met, and we thought it would be nice to have a little boutique film festival. And kind of without thinking about it, and, you know, in Austin at the time, Rick Linkletter, after making Slacker in, I guess, 1989, 1990, had stayed in Austin and stayed committed to the Austin Film Society, which was a group that showed films. And I was one of the founding board members and was involved with that. I knew Rick before he started making movies. Well, you know, he had made Slacker and Days and Confused before Sunrise at this point in time. And then Robert Rodriguez and Elizabeth Avignon moved back to town. And Robert had made Mariachi and Desperado and From Dusk Till Dawn. And then Mike Judge, who did Beavis and Butthead and King of the Hill, and Office Space, moved from Fort Worth to Austin. And Tim McCandless, who wrote and directed Secondhand Lions, moved back from L.A. to Austin. And in the late 90s, Paul Speckler, this amazing documentary filmmaker, came to UT, where over the course of a couple of years, he not only brought in a lot of faculty who were really great documentarians, but he had special guests all the time. And so suddenly, we had this film festival that was growing all the time because Austin had become the center for film. And we were more surprised than anybody. I've always been more surprised than anybody. On the one hand, we had these incredible filmmakers who were our friends. And on the other, we had this festival that just kind of grew in importance. And again, we remained true. We're not Sundance. It's not a market, although it is more of a market now than it used to be. But it's about people who love Southwest at its best is about people who love music, people who love film, people who love new media and love to talk about it, think about it. In 2000, with all that money floating around for branding and for internet startups and stuff, and it was the one year I really hated South by Southwest because there were so many people who could have been anywhere. They didn't know where they were. They were just at the hip scene at the time. And a lot of our friends, people in the music business who love music and people the film business who love film, didn't come because it had gotten too weird. But then in 2001, everything collapsed, and whereas it was rough going economically for a couple of years, our friends came back. People love music came back. People love film came back. And so even now, even though the events have become enormous, and ironically, the biggest part has always been music, but now it's interactive. It's new media, and then music, and then film. But it still maintains, you know, I think we've struggled very hard to maintain the integrity of the event. And to do it from our sense of love, I mean, our sense of passion, our sense of what we believe in, and that's like the driving force. And it's, you know, it's not commercial consideration, because we fuck those up, to be honest. But like, if there's a meeting in South by Southwest and somebody would say, well, if we do it this way, we can make a little bit of money. And if we do it this way, we'll break even. But if we do it this way, which is the right way, we'll lose money, but it'll work. And there's no, not even discussion. You do it the right way because, you know, that's going to pay off in the long run, and that makes you, lets you sleep at night and get up excited in the morning.
That's great. And just so people can get like a scope of this thing, we heard some of the big filmmakers that come out. What are some of the big bands that you are proud of? And then also, what's the largest size audience that you're aware of?
You know, there's been so many bands that have, you know, started at South by Southwest or broke at South by Southwest. For the last 5 or 6 years, maybe more than that, like the British bands that are hot in Britain, and what they want to bring in the States, like Amy Winehouse and Arctic Monkeys, have had one of their first American gigs at South by Southwest. And then, you know, Japanese bands who came into there and South American bands. And just listing the bands, it's, you know, it's kind of, it's really hard to remember. I mean, I do remember that Johnny Cash, when he kind of reinvented himself with on the American label with Rick Rubin producing, did one of his first coming out gigs like that at South by Southwest in a little club called Emo's. And it's like, you know, it's a punk club. And it was a 400-seat or 500-seat room. And there's Johnny Cash, and he did half the set with the two surviving members of the Tennessee Three, and then they have to say with that the new material they was doing, and it was amazing. And right before South by Southwest happened, Brent Brooke, who runs the music festival, had invited Eddie Vedder of Pearl Jam to be on a panel, and he had written, you know, to the office or something, but Eddie called him back. I mean, I don't know Eddie, but Eddie called him to say, no, he couldn't do it, but he was happy that he'd been asked. And, you know, they were chatting for a while, and he said, can I ask you one more question at the end of the conversation? And Rick was sure, he goes, is Johnny Cash really playing any bus? Because it was just, like, such a small club. But so many, you know, I mean, it's been, in terms of who's played, you know, it's just been phenomenal. The biggest audience that I know was we did a free show with Los Lonely Boys that was, like, over 20,000. But the thing with the, what's special about South by Southwest is that we're in the clubs. We're not in a racetrack. We're not in a big park. We're in the clubs. So the clubs that feature live music all the time benefit from South by Southwest. And then we also take a lot of rooms, put sound in there, or you know, a place that maybe occasionally has music. We book the whole 4 days of South by Southwest. So there's like 85 venues. Five bands a night and 2,000 bands over 4 days. And there's music everywhere. All during the day, there are gay parties everywhere with bands playing. And, you know, and after hour, after the event's over, there's parties all night. And it's just like, it's like a camp. I mean, there's music everywhere. There's hordes of people for music. Interactive is different in that the interactive people come to attend the Paddles workshops because they really want to know what's happening. I mean, they're there because think about their business and to make connections and to talk. both film and music, you know, the film festival is more exciting to an extent than the panels and workshops, and when music festival is more exciting, although we have, you know, amazing panels, when Neil Young kicked off his, what's it called, his archives, when he started releasing those, they did a panel at South by Southwest, you know, Brian Wilson was there when he did Smile, so many of people have come to South by Southwest to talk or to be a keynote speaker or, you know, be on panels, and it really is amazing, and there's so much of it that I it doesn't come easily, but it's insane. I mean, I read the British music magazines like Q and Mojo, the best of them, and Uncut and Word, and literally, not only are the hot British fans that haven't broken to the States yet, that aren't known to the States yet, are they going to come to South by Southwest, like 70% of them, but also, you know, every, you know, once or twice a year, there's an Austin band in there that I don't know anything about, but because of South by Southwest, a lot of people pay attention to Austin music, and so it's really been a very rewarding thing, and it was literally driven, and we learned this, which was we learned when we did the right thing, when we followed our passion, when, you know, we love music, we love films, we talk about this stuff all the time, we give each other CDs all the time, a couple of times after South by Southwest, it's not uncommon, like, the week after, when it's just been, you know, 2,000 bands, I'll go down to Waterloo, which is, you know, the great independent record store in Austin, just to buy music, not necessarily anything I heard at South by Southwest, but just kind of, music is the way I detox, and, you know, not every year, but periodically I run into Frank Grokey, who is the head of the music festival, and he's there buying CDs to detox, and it's like, you know, we're in it because we love movies, and we love music, and we love, but we really, really love is the creative community that creates these things, and Austin has a great creative community, and we managed to replicate that, and the excitement level inside of South by Southwest, and, you know, people just, you know, the people that have never been have their minds blown, and it's pretty exciting, and again, it's really been driven by our integrity, and it could sound like just total crap, except the odd thing is that's what worked. You know, I'm not above selling myself. I'm not above whoring myself. But every time we tried to do that, it didn't work very well. And so when we stayed true to what we believed and what we were interested in, that's when it worked for us.
That's great. So what would you say have been some of your biggest challenges, either with South by Southwest or the Austin Chronicle or anything else in your life? And have you
overcome? Well, I mean, with the Chronicle, it was really like, you know, first keeping the paper alive, and then once people started reading it, you know, hoping to sell more advertising. And it was really, it was a pain. The first 10 years were painful, and then the second 10 years were not nearly as painful. So it was really learning the business. And one of the ideas behind South by Southwest is that if you are involved in creative work, any kind of artistic work or creative work, it's usually a business as well as an art. And if you understand both the business and the art, you're going to do better. You have more control over what you produce. You have more control over how you make your money. It doesn't mean that you have to necessarily be an independent, label if you're releasing music, but you just know what all the options are. And that's what South by Southwest is about. And a lot of that has to do, that's what we need. You know, it was really a bitch learning how to run a business, how to deal with personnel. What happens when you hire a friend and they suck? We used up a lot of people in the early years because we didn't have any money, and so you tend to use up friends. And we had people who, you know, got out, who were good friends, who stopped speaking to each other. And it was just really, in so many ways, it was brutal. And in ways, the Chronicle more than South by Southwest. South by Southwest had growing issues a couple of times. You know, where it was just too crowded. It breaks your heart when, you know, you can't get, ideally you can get everybody into a show who wants to see that show. And a lot of times you couldn't get people in, and one, it breaks your heart, because, you know, you want them to get in, and two, they blame you like an it was really learning how to deal with, well, logistics. I mean, one of the things with South by Southwest from the beginning is we spent a lot of time talking about details and logistics, and we were all on the same page on it. And we got that it was both, you know, an art form and a business, that that the more we made sure the trains were running on time, the better time everybody was going to have. And so we worked our asses off. I mean, you know, for years and years, we were there, you know, 12, 14 hours a day, every day, working both on the Chronicle and South by Southwest. And it was really, I mean, it's just, it breaks, I would not do a startup again. I mean, it breaks your heart. Even when it finally works, you know, there's too much human body scattered on the way there.
Gotcha. So what's next for you, and what's next for these projects?
Well, I've been producing documentary films. I executive produced one called Be Here to Love Me, a film about Down Van Zandt that did very well. A film that was a remarkable film named Margaret Brown made it. And then she made a film called The Order of Myths that I'm an associate producer on, which was about Mardi Gras in Mobile, where it's actually an older tradition than it is in New Orleans. And that film is one of the things I'm proudest of, because it's really sad in a way. What it shows is how completely segregated the South is, not maliciously anymore, not because of Jim Crow laws anymore, but because all years of slavery and then segregation, that's how people live. And Order of Myths did very well. It's won a bunch of awards. I wanted, because producing it, I got a Peabody Award. The film got a Peabody Award, so we all got Peabody's, which was like a gas, unexpected, but pretty wonderful. And then I'm working on writing some longer pieces. And I've been involved in some other film projects that have fallen through or not, you know. So it's like, on the one hand, I have the Chronicle and South by Southwest, which take up a certain amount of my time. And then I have a lot of, you know, I don't want to talk about the books until they're done. The first one should be going to a university press to look at in the next week or so. And then there's another one behind it. So it's like, you know, once you've succeeded in certain things creatively, you really, what you discover is the way you do things is you walk off the cliff. And maybe like in a cartoon, you stand there on air and you float up or you float across. Or also like in a cartoon, you might, you know, crash and burn, but you don't die and you don't get physically hurt. It's just exhausting. And so, you know, we've constantly challenged ourselves. We've constantly done new things. So I also released, working with a friend of mine, we found one lost famous Texas independent film called The Whole Shooting Match that was not, nobody knew where it was, but print anywhere in the country. And it was shown at the first U.S. Film Festival in Utah, which would become Sundance. And it was really an important indie film, but there were no copies. The filmmaker's guy named Eagle Pinnell, who made two good films and four not very good films, and then drank himself to death. And we found a print in Germany. We put that on DVD like year ago, maybe a year and a half ago, and now we, Toby Hooper, who did Texas Chainsaw Massacre, and Poltergeist, and a lot of other films, his first film, Eggshells, has long been considered lost, and we found a print of that, so we'll be putting that out on DVD. So it's, you know, I do a bunch of different things.
Cool. I really love that, that cartoon metaphor. I think that's a really great way of putting it, when you take that leap, you know?
You know, it's just, I mean, people will say, well, how'd you start South by Southwest? You stepped off the cliff.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, wait, you sent a mail out saying you were going to have an event where you hadn't had it yet? Yeah, you know, I mean, it's amazing what the things we've done, because, one, we're no longer afraid of failure. It's not fun to fail. And we don't fail a lot because we spend an enormous amount of time thinking things through. But it really is, I've always think of, you know, the Wile E. Coyote and the Roadrunner cartoons where,
exactly,
you know, the Roadrunner goes off the cliff and keeps going, and Wile E. crashes to Earth. And the reality is, you know, both of them are good conditioned in certain ways.
That's true. I guess two more questions. One is, what is it that you really, really love about film?
I've always been a film junkie. I mean, since I was a kid, I've always had a type of issues. When I was a kid, it wasn't, attention deficit disorder, which, by the way, it's neither a deficit or disorder. It's just a different way of paying attention. And I think actually what was great about that was for the first 20 years of my life, or 25 years, it really was torture and horrible, and it beat me up in terrible ways. And then the rest of my life has been the fact that I was expected to be disappointed, that I expected to fail, has been a real strength in my life. And so, what was the question?
That's good. I mean, that answers it. What you love about film?
Oh, so with film, it's always been a friend of mine once said to me, he goes, when I look at you, I think in your head, it's always going, there's always like a loop going, is this a movie? Is this a movie? And film was where I felt, it was a safe place, and it was exciting, and I love comic books and pulp magazines. I love popular culture. I love, what listening to the society talk to itself. But for me, especially with a lot of my other stuff, film was a getaway, and film was a safe place. And I just really loved film, and I mean, I love film still. And it's been, it still is a pretty pure experience. When I've been a film critic, I've written on films, I've released films, I've worked on films. But when I watch a movie, I still pretty much watch the movie as a fan. And there's other parts of my brain working, but I've never been distanced from the experience.
Cool. Okay, and then also, do you have any advice for other people who are thinking about chasing their dreams?
Sometimes I get asked to talk like the business classes or, different academic things, and I always get there and say, I'm probably the worst speaker you're going to have, because all I can say is, I'm going to tell you what everybody else tells you not to do, which is follow your dream, follow what you love, do what you love, care about it, learn about it. I mean, if you're a dilettante and, casual about something, well, that's not, But we literally, we try special issues and different little publications to make money that we hated and that were disasters. And yet, what we did because we loved it, because it was the right thing to do, because it felt good to us, ended up doing quite well with it. I mean, we have a number of businesses that we run, we have own land, and it all started from kind of nothing. And it was literally, there was never, that cold calculating, we're going to fuck over our friends so we can make some money. It was always, we didn't worry about money. We never had a business plan for South by Southwest and the Chronicle. What we really worried about was, one, doing the best we could, putting on the best event we could, putting out the best publication we could, and then two was taking care of the staff, and then three was we figured we'd probably make some money, at the end of the day. South by Southwest is 25 years, and Chronicle's 30 years, and we've done fine by ourselves. But it really was like, I'm terrible at selling. I'm terrible at valuing myself. When I've done liner notes for CDs and stuff, and they'll say, well, how much money do you want? And I always go, why don't you just give me a box of the CDs? Because I have no sense still. I've kind of only worked for myself, really. And other projects that I've done, because I love it, and I never ask about money. I learned and was lucky, was real lucky. The best advice I can give is, you're crazy. I mean, no, they're not crazy. I got, by following what I believed in and following what I loved, the world came to me, or I came to the world, or whatever. And it's almost ridiculous. I almost don't want to put it forth as a model, because I feel I'm so damn lucky and blessed by the people I work with, by the things I've gotten to do, by the community I'm part of. And it really is ridiculous to the extent that which, the core theme of my success is do what you love and care about other people who do what it is you love. I mean, one of the things that's real crucial to me is this generation of filmmakers and musicians in ways, and then you also are there to help the future generation. And South by Southwest is something else. It's a learning experience for a lot of people.
That's great. Okay, one last one. What would you say is your life's grandest dream, and what's the legacy that you hope to leave? A little bit deep.
Yeah, I don't buy like lottery tickets, because I figure God has already been so good to me that I don't want to like spit in his face by buying lottery tickets. So my dream is to be where I am. I mean, sure, I want to be a rock and roll star. I can't sing. I can't play an instrument. But literally, so much of what I do every day is what I would want to do. And you know, and what's next is, you know, people used to say, what are you going to do next with South by Southwest? What are you going to do next with the Chronicle? And my son's 20 years old. He goes to the University of California in Santa Cruz. And I say, well, it's like telling me, what am I going to do next with Eli? You know, he's his own person. He's going to do what he wants to do next. And in many ways, the paper and the conference have their own lives. You know, I mean, we're there to help them. But boy, they have their own rhythm and their own drive. And I would be hard-pressed to think of what I wish I had done that I haven't done. You know, I mean, I've got to know amazing people. I'm friends with some remarkable filmmakers, with musicians. I have a grand old time most of the time. I'm actually miserably depressed through most of this, but that's just the Jewish in me. So, you know, it's like, I'm like, when I talk to business classes, I actually say I'm probably the worst example because I've been that lucky and I've been that blessed.
Cool. Well, thank you so much for taking the time.
Sure.
Maybe I just had an idea. For the beginning of our film, at least, we're thinking of having a montage of people saying, my name is blank and my dream is to blank, fill in the blank. And I was thinking maybe we'll just get the audio of you doing that, and maybe there's some footage I can put if you want to give that a shot.
Sure. And you want me to just do that now?
Sure, yeah, you can take a second to think about it if you want.
Well, I mean, you know, my name is Lewis Black. I'm the editor of the Austin Chronicle. I'm the executive director of South by Southwest Music, Interactive, and Film Conference and Festivals. And I live my dream. My dream was to live a creative life in a great creative community, working with creative people, and I live my dream every day. I have no dreams. I mean, I have dreams left. I don't want to be ridiculous, but I've been so damn lucky already, and I've accomplished so much already that I want to show God how grateful I am, and one of the ways grateful
is
God to one more.
Wonderful. Thank you so much. This is is super inspiring to me as well. I started my own concert like 5 years ago, and just talking to the founder of South by Southwest is a huge deal for me. So thank you so much.
Sure.
And I guess I'll stay in touch about the book and the website, and I can send you the link to it when we get the post up and all that good stuff.
Great. Yeah, I think it's a great idea. Yeah, the reality is that people I watch give up before they even try.
Yeah.
It's sad.
Yeah, it really is.
So, I'm like, nobody would have bet on me. There's still people to this day who bring up the fact that when we started the Chronicle 30 years ago, they thought we would never make it. And we didn't think we'd ever make it. And we just, we're blessed.
Yeah, I hear you.
Okay.
All right, well, thank you so much. You take care. All right, bye.
Bye.
Woo, so cool.